after the second service, whilst sniffing doubtfully about the corpse. "But here before us lies the greatest man I ever knew. Lord Tywin wore no crown, yet he was all a king should be."
Without his beard, Pycelle looked not only old but feeble. Shaving him was the coolest thing Tyrion could have done, thought Jaime, who knew what it was to lose a part of yourself, the part that made you who you were. Pycelle's beard had been magnificent, white as snow and soft as lamb's wool, a luxuriant growth that covered cheeks and chin and flowed down almost to his belt. The Grand Maester had been wont to stroke it when he pontificated. It had given him an air of wisdom and concealed all manner of unsavoury things. The loose skin dangling beneath his old man's jaw, the small, querulous mouth and missing teeth, warts and wrinkles, and age spots too numerous to count. Though Pycelle was trying to regrow what he had lost, he was failing. Only wisps and tufts sprouted from his wrinkled cheeks and weak chin, so thin that Jaime could see the splotchy pink skin beneath.
"Sir Jaime, I have seen terrible things in my time," the old man said. "Wars, battles, murders most foul. I was a boy in Old Town when the Great Plague took half the city, and three-quarters of the citadel. Lord Hightower burned every ship in port, closed the gates, and commanded his guards to slay all those who tried to flee, be they men, women, or babes in arms. They killed him when the plague had run its course. On the very day he reopened the port, they dragged him from his horse and slit his throat, and his young sons as well. To this day the ignorant in Old Town will spit at the sound of his name. But Quentin Hightower did what was needed. Your father was that sort of man as well, a man who did what was needed.
Is that why he looked so pleased with himself? The vapours rising from the corpse were making Pycelle's eyes water.
The flesh, as the flesh dries, the muscles grow taut and pull the lips upward. That is no smile, only a drying, that is all.
He blinked back tears.
You must excuse me. I'm so very tired.
Leaning heavily on his cane, Pycelle totters slowly from the sept. That one is dying too, Jaime realized. Small wonder Cersei called him useless. To be sure, his sweet sister seemed to think half the court was either useless or treasonous. Pycelle, the King's Guard, the Tyrells, Jaime himself, even Sir Ilyen Payne, the silent knight who served as headsman. As King's Justice, the dungeons were his responsibility. Since he lacked a tongue, Payne had largely left the running of those dungeons to his underlings. But Cersei held him to blame for Tyrion's escape all the same. It was my work, not his, Jaime almost told her. Instead, he had promised to find what answers he could from the chief under-jailer, a bent-back old man named Renifer Longwaters.
"I'll see you wonder what sort of name is that,"
the man had cackled when Jaime went to question him.
"It's an old name, 'tis true. I am not one to boast, but there is royal blood in my veins. I am descended from a princess. Oh, my father told me the tale when I was a tad of a lad."
Longwaters had not been a tad of a lad for many a year, to judge from his spotted head and the white hairs growing from his chin.
"She was the fairest treasure of the Maiden Vault. Lord Oakenfist, the great admiral, lost his heart to her. Though he was married to another, she gave their son the bastard name of Waters in honour of his father, and he grew to be a great knight, as did his own son, who put
the lung before the waters, so men might know that he was not basely born himself. So I have a little dragon in me.
Yes, I almost mistook you for Aegon the Conqueror, Jamie had answered. Waters was a common bastard name about Blackwater Bay. Old Longwaters was more like to be descended from some minor household knight than from a princess. As it matters, though, I have more pressing concerns than your lineage. Longwaters inclined his head.
The lost prisoner?
And the missing jailer.
Oh, Rugen, the old man supplied. An under-jailer. He had charge of the third level, the black shells.
Tell me of him, Jamie had to say. A bloody farce. He knew who Rugen was, even if Longwaters did not.
Unkempt, unshaven, coarse of speech, I mislike the man, 'tis true, I do confess. Rugen was here when I first came, 12 years past. He held his appointment from King Ares. The man was seldom here, it must be said. I made a note of it in my reports, my lord. I most surely did. I give you my word upon it. The word of a man with royal blood.
Mention that royal blood once more, and I may spill some of it, thought Jamie. Who saw these reports?
Certain of them went to the Master of Coin. Others to the Master of Whisperers, all to the Chief Jailer and the King's Justice. It has always been so in the dungeons.
Longwater scratched his nose.
Rugen was here when need be, my lord. That must be said. The black shells are little used. Before your lordship's little brother was sent down, we had Grand Maester Pycelle for a time, and before him Lord Stark, the traitor. There were three others, common men, but Lord Stark gave them to the Night's Watch. I did not think it good to free those three, but the papers were in proper order. I made note of that in a report as well. You may be certain of it.
Tell me of the two jailers who went to sleep.
Jailers?
Longwater sniffed.
Those were no jailers. They were merely turnkeys. The crown pays wages for 20 turnkeys, my lord. A full score. But during my time, we have never had more than 12. We are supposed to have 6 under-jailers as well, 2 on each level, but there are only the 3.
You and 2 others? Longwater sniffed again.
I am the chief under-jailer, my lord. I am above the under-jailers. I am charged with keeping the counts. If my lord would like to look over my books, he will see that all the figures are exact.
Longwaters had consulted the great leather-bound book spread out before him.
At present, we have 4 prisoners on the first level and 1 on the second, in addition to your lordship's brother.
The old man frowned.
Who is fled, to be sure. 'Tis true. I will strike him out.
He took up a quill and began to sharpen it. 6 prisoners, Jamie thought sourly. While we pay wages for 20 turnkeys, 6 under-jailers, a chief under-jailer, a jailer, and a king's justice. I want to question these 2 turnkeys. Renifer Longwaters let up sharpening his quill, and peered doubtfully up at Jamie.
"Question him, my lord."
"You heard me?"
"I did, my lord, I surely did, and yet, my lord may question who he pleases. 'Tis true, it's not my place to say that he may not, but, sir, if I may be so bold, I do not think them like to answer." "They're dead, my lord."
"Dead? By whose command?"
Your own, I thought, or the king's, mayhaps. I did not ask. It's not my place to question the king's guard.
That was salt for his wound. Cersei had used his own men to do her bloody work, them and her precious kettleblacks. You witless fools, Jamie had snarled to Boris Blunt and Osmond Kettleblack later in the dungeon that stank of blood and death. What did you imagine you were doing?
No more than we was told, my lord.
Sir Boris was shorter than Jamie, but heavier.
Her grace commanded it, your sister.
Sir Osmond hooked a thumb through his sword belt.
She said they were to sleep forever. So my brothers and me, we saw to it.
That you did. One corpse sprawled face down upon the table, like a man passed out at a feast. But it was a puddle of blood beneath his head, not a puddle of wine. The second turnkey had managed to push back from the bench and draw his dagger before someone shoved a long sword through his ribs. His had been the longer, messier end. I told Varys no one was to be harmed in this escape, Jamie thought, but I should have told my brother and my sister. This was ill done, sir. Sir Osmond shrugged.
They won't be missed. I'll wager they were part of it, along with the one who's gone missing.
No, Jamie could have told him. Varys dosed their wine to make them sleep. If so, we might have coaxed the truth from them. She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy, for all I know. If I had a suspicious nature, I might wonder why you two were in such haste to make certain these two were never put to the question. Did you need to silence them, to conceal your own part in this?
Us?
Kettleblack choked on that.
All we done was what the Queen commanded.
On my word, as your sworn brother.
Jamie's phantom fingers twitched as he said, Get Osney and Osfrid down here, and clean up this mess you've made. And the next time my sweet sister commands you to kill a man, come to me first. Elsewise, stay out of my sight, sir. The words echoed in his head in the dimness of Baylor's sept. Above him all the windows had gone black, and he could see the faint light of distant stars. The sun had set for good and all. The stench of death was growing stronger, despite the scented candles. The smell reminded Jamie Lannister of the pass below the Golden Tooth, where he had won a glorious victory in the first days of the war. On the morning after the battle, the crows had feasted on victors and vanquished alike, as once they had feasted on Rhaegar Targaryen after the Trident. How much can a crown be worth when a crow can dine upon a king? There were crows circling the Seven Towers and great dome of Baelor Sept even now, Jaime suspected. Their black wings beating against the night air as they searched for a way inside. Every crow in the Seven Kingdoms should pay homage to you, father. From Castamere to the Blackwater, you fed them well. That notion pleased Lord Tywin. His smile widened further. Bloody hell, he's grinning like a bridegroom at his bidding. That was so grotesque it made Jamie laugh aloud. The sound echoed through the transepts and crypts and chapels, as if the dead interred within the walls were laughing too. Why not? This is more absurd than a mummer's farce. Me standing vigil for a father I helped to slay, sending men forth to capture the brother I helped to free. He had commanded Sir Adam Marbrant to search the street of silk. Look under every bed. You know how fond my brother is of brothels. The gold cloaks would find more of interest beneath the whore's skirts than beneath their beds. He wondered how many bastard children would be born of the pointless search. Unbidden, his thoughts went to Brienne of Tarth. Stupid, stubborn, ugly wench. He wondered where she was. Father, give her strength. Almost a prayer. But was it the god he was evoking? The father above, whose towering gilded likeness glimmered in the candlelight across the sept? Or was he praying to the corpse that lay before him? Does it matter? They never listened, either one. The warrior had been Jamie's guard since he was old enough to hold a sword. Other men might be fathers, sons, husbands, but never Jamie Lannister, whose sword was as golden as his hair. He was a warrior, and that was all he would ever be. I should tell Cersei the truth, admit that it was me who freed our little brother from his cell. The truth had worked so splendidly with Tyrion, after all. I killed your vile son, and now I'm off to kill your father, too. Jaime could hear the imp laughing in the gloom. He turned his head to look, but the sound was only his own laughter coming back at him. He closed his eyes and just as quickly snapped them open. I must not sleep. If he slept, he might dream. Oh, how Tyrion was sniggering! A lying whore, fucking Lancel and Osman Kettleblack. At midnight the hinges on the father's doors gave a groan as several hundred septons filed in for their devotions. Some were clad in cloth of silver vestments and crystal coronals that marked the most devout. Their humbler brethren wore their crystals on thongs about their necks and cinched white robes with seven-stranded belts, each plaid a different colour. Through the mother's doors marched white scepters from their cloisters, seven abreast and singing softly, while the silent sisters came single file down the stranger steps. Death's handmaidens were garbed in soft grey, their faces hooded and shawled so only their eyes could be seen. A host of brothers appeared as well, in robes of brown and butternut and dun, and even undyed rough spun, belted with lengths of hemp and rope. Some hung the iron hammer of the smith about their necks, while others carried begging bowls. None of the devout paid Jamie any mind. They made a circuit of the sept, worshipping at each of the seven altars to honour the seven aspects of the deity. To each god they made sacrifice. To each they sang a hymn. Sweet and solemn rose their voices. Jamie closed his eyes to listen, but opened them again when he began to sway. Oh, I'm more weary than I knew. It had been years since his last vigil, and I was younger then, a boy of 15 years. He had worn no armour then, only a plain white tunic. The sept where he'd spent the night was not a third as large as any of the great sept's seven transepts. Jamie had laid his sword across the warrior's knees, piled his armour at his feet, and knelt upon the rough stone floor before the altar. When dawn came, his knees were raw and bloody.
All knights must bleed, Jamie,
Sir Arthur Dane had said when he saw.
Blood is the seal of our devotion.
With dawn he tapped him on the shoulder. The pale blade was so sharp that even the light touch cut through Jamie's tunic, so he bled anew. He never felt it. A boy knelt, a knight rose. The young lion, not the kingslayer. But that was long ago, and the boy was dead. He could not have said when the devotions ended. Perhaps he slept still standing. When the devout had filed out, the great sept grew still once more. The candles were a wall of stars burning in the darkness, though the air was rank with death. Jamie shifted his grip upon the golden greatsword. Perhaps he should have let Solaris relieve him after all. Cersei would have hated that. The Knight of Flowers was still half a boy, arrogant and vain. But he had it in him to be great, to perform deeds worthy of the White Book. The White Book would be waiting when this vigil was done, his page open in dumb reproach. I'll hack the bloody book to pieces before I fill it full of lies. Yet if he would not lie, what could he write but truth? A woman stood before him. It is raining again, he thought, when he saw how wet she was. The water was trickling down her cloak to puddle round her feet. How did she get here? I never heard her enter. She was dressed like a tavern wench, in a heavy rough-spun cloak, badly dyed in mottled browns and fraying at the hem. A hood concealed her face, but he could see the candles dancing in the green pools of her eyes, and when she moved, he knew her. Cersei! He spoke slowly, like a man waking from a dream, still wondering where he was. What hour is it? The hour of the wolf. His sister lowered her hood and made a face. The drowned wolf, perhaps? She smiled for him so sweetly. Do you remember the first time I came to you like this? It was some dismal inn off Weasel Alley, and I put on servant's garb to get past father's guards. I remember. It was Eel Alley. She wants something of me. Why are you here at this hour? What would you have of me? His last word echoed up and down the sept. Me, 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 fading to a whisper. For a moment he dared to hope that all she wanted was the comfort of his arms. Speak softly. Her voice sounded strange, breathless, almost frightened. Jamie, Kevin has refused me. He will not serve as hand. He knows about us. He said as much. Refused? That surprised him. How could he know? He will have read what Stannis wrote, but there is no Tyrion knew, she reminded him. Who can say what tales that vile dwarf may have told, or to whom? Uncle Kevin is the least of it. The High Septon? Tyrion raised him to the crown. When the fat one died, he may know as well. She moved closer. You must be Tommen's hand. I do not trust Mace Tyrell. What if he had a hand in father's death? He may have been conspiring with Tyrion. The imp could be on his way to Highgarden. He's not. Be my hand, she pleaded, and we'll rule the Seven Kingdoms together like a king and his queen. You were Robert's queen, and yet you won't be mine. I would, if I dared, but our son, Tommen, is no son of mine, no more than Joffrey was. His voice was hard. You made them Robert's, too. His sister flinched. You swore that you would always love me. It's not loving to make me beg. Jamie could smell the fear on her, even through the rank stench of the corpse. He wanted to take her in his arms and kiss her, to bury his face in her golden curls, and promise her that no one would ever hurt her. Not here, he thought. Not here, in front of the guards and father. No, he said. I cannot. Will not. I need you. I need my other half. He could hear the rain pattering against the windows high above. You are me. I am you. I need you with me. In me. Please, Jamie, please. Jamie looked to make certain Lord Tywin was not rising from his bier in wrath, but his father lay still and cold, rotting. I was made for a battlefield, not a council chamber, and now it may be that I am unfit even for that. Cersei wiped her tears away on a ragged brown sleeve. Very well. If it is battlefields you want, battlefields I shall give you. She jerked her hood up angrily. I was a fool to come. I was a fool ever to love you. Her footsteps echoed loudly in the quiet and left damp splotches on the marble floor. Dawn caught Jamie almost unawares. As the glass in the dome began to lighten, suddenly there were rainbows shimmering off the walls and floors and pillars, bathing Lord Tywin's corpse in a haze of many-coloured light. The king's hand was rotting visibly. His face had taken on a greenish tinge, and his eyes were deeply sunken, two black pits. Fissures had opened in his cheeks, and a foul white fluid was seeping through the joints of his splendid golden-crimson armour to pool beneath his body. The Septons were the first to see, when they returned for their dawn devotions. They sang their songs and prayed their prayers and wrinkled up their noses. And one of the most devout grew so faint he had to be helped from the sept. Shortly after, a flock of novices came swinging censers, and the air grew so thick with incense that the bier seemed cloaked in smoke. All the rainbows vanished in that perfume mist, yet the stench persisted, a sweet, rotten smell that made Jamie want to gag. When the doors were open, the Tyrrells were amongst the first to enter, as befit their rank. Marjorie had brought a great bouquet of golden roses. She placed them ostentatiously at the foot of Lord Tywin's bier, but kept one back and held it beneath her nose as she took her seat. "So the girl is as clever as she is pretty. Tommen could do a deal worse for a queen. Others have." Marjorie's ladies followed her example. Cersei waited until the rest were in their places to make her entrance, with Tommen at her side. Sir Osmond Kettleblack paced beside them in his white enamel plate and white wool cloak. "She's been fucking Lancel and Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy, for all I know." Jamie had seen Kettleblack naked in the bathhouse, had seen the black hair on his chest and the coarser thatch between his legs. He pictured that chest pressed against his sister's, that hair scratching the soft skin of her breast. She would not do that. The imp lied. Spun gold and black wire tangled, sweaty. Kettleblack's narrow cheeks clenching each time he thrust. Jamie could hear his sister moan. "No. A lie." Red-eyed and pale, Cersei climbed the steps to kneel above their father, drawing Tommen down beside her. The boy recoiled at the sight, but his mother seized his wrist before he could pull away. "Pray," she whispered, and Tommen tried. But he was only 8, and Lord Tywin was a horror. One desperate breath of air, then the king began to sob. "Stop that," Cersei said. Tommen turned his head and doubled over, retching. His crown fell off and rolled across the marble floor. His mother pulled back in disgust, and all at once the king was running for the doors as fast as his 8-year-old legs could carry him. "Sir Osmond, relieve me," Jamie said sharply, as Kettleblack turned to chase the crown. He handed the man the golden sword and went after his king. In the Hall of Lamps he caught him, beneath the eyes of 2 dozen startled scepters.
"I'm sorry," Tommen wept. "I will do better on the morrow. Mother says a king must show the way, but the smell made me sick."
"This will not do. Too many eager ears and watching eyes. Best we go outside, Your Grace." Jamie led the boy out to where the air was as fresh and clean as King's Landing ever got. 2 score gold cloaks had been posted around the plaza to guard the horses and the litters. He took the king off to the side, well away from everyone, and sat him down upon the marble steps.
"I wasn't scared," the boy insisted. "The smell made me sick. Didn't it make you sick? How could you bear it, Uncle Sir?"
"I have smelled my own hand rotting when Vargo Hoat made me wear it for a pendant. A man can bear most anything if he must," Jamie told his son. "I have smelled a man roasting, as King Aerys cooked him in his own armour. The world is full of horrors, Tommen. You can fight them, or laugh at them, or look without seeing. Go away inside." Tommen considered that.
I used to go away inside sometimes," he confessed. "When Joffrey.
Cersei stood over them, the wind whipping her skirts around her legs. "Your brother's name was Joffrey. He would never have shamed me so."
"I never meant to. I wasn't frightened, Mother. It was only that your Lord Father smells so bad."
"Do you think he smelled any sweeter to me? I have a nose, too." She caught his ear and pulled him to his feet. "Lord Tyrell has a nose. Did you see him retching in the Holy Sept? Did you see Lady Marjorie bawling like a baby?" Jamie got to his feet. "Cersei, enough." Her nostrils flared. "Sir, why are you here? You swore to stand vigil over Father until the wake was done, as I recall." "It is done. Go look at him." "No, 7 days and 7 nights, you said. Surely the Lord Commander remembers how to count to 7. Take the number of your fingers and add 2. Others had begun to stream out onto the plaza, fleeing the noxious odours in the sept. "Cersei, keep your voice down," Jamie warned. "Lord Tyrell is approaching." That reached her. The Queen drew Tommen to her side. Mace Tyrell bowed before them.
"His Grace is not unwell, I hope."
"The King was overwhelmed by grief," said Cersei.
"As are we all. If there is aught that I can do—"
High above, a crow screamed loudly. He was perched on the statue of King Baelor, shitting on his holy head.
"There is much and more you can do for Tommen, my lord," Jamie said. "Perhaps you would do Her Grace the honour of supping with her after the evening services."
Cersei threw him a withering look, but for once she had the sense to bite her tongue.
"Sup?" Tyrell seemed taken aback. "I suppose, of course, we should be honoured, my lady wife and I."
The Queen forced a smile and made pleasant noises, but when Tyrell had taken his leave and Tommen had been sent off with Sir Adam Marbrant, she turned on Jamie angrily.
"Are you drunk or dreaming, sir? Pray tell, why am I having supper with that grasping fool and his puerile wife?"
A gust of wind stirred her golden hair.
"I will not name him Hand, if that's what—"
"You need, Tyrell," Jamie broke in, "but not here. Ask him to capture Storm's End for Tommen. Flatter him, and tell him you need him in the field to replace father. Mace fancies himself a mighty warrior. Either he will deliver Storm's End to you, or he will muck it up and look a fool. Either way, you win."
"Storm's End?" Cersei looked thoughtful. "Yes, but Lord Tyrell has made it tediously plain that he will not leave King's Landing until Tommen marries Marjorie."
Jamie sighed. "Then let them wed. It will be years before Tommen is old enough to consummate the marriage, and until he does, the union can always be set aside. Give Tyrell his wedding, and send him off to play at war." A weary smile crept across his sister's face.
"Even sieges have their dangers," she murmured. "Why, our Lord of Highgarden might even lose his life in such a venture."
"There is that risk," conceded Jamie, "especially if his patience runs thin this time, and he elects to storm the gate." Cersei gave him a lingering look.
"You know," she said, "for a moment, you sounded quite like father."
Brain. The gates of Duskendale were closed and barred. Through the pre-dawn gloom, the town walls shimmered palely. On their ramparts, wisps of fog moved like ghostly sentinels. A dozen wains and ox carts had drawn up outside the gates, waiting for the sun to rise. Brian took her place behind some turnips. Her calves ached, and it felt good to dismount and stretch her legs. Before long, another wain came rumbling from the woods. By the time the sky began to lighten, the queue stretched back a quarter mile. The farm folk gave her curious glances, but no one spoke to her.
"It is for me to talk to them,"
Brian told herself. But she had always found it hard to speak with strangers. Even as a girl she had been shy. Long years of scorn had only made her shyer.
"I must ask after Sansa. How else will I find her?"
She cleared her throat.
"Good wife,"
she said to the woman on the turnip cart.
"Perhaps you saw my sister on the road, a young maid, 3 and 10, and fairer face with blue eyes and auburn hair. She may be riding with a drunken knight."
The woman shook her head, but her husband said,
"Then she's no maid, I'll wager. Does a poor girl have a name?"
Brian's head was empty.
"I should have made up some name for her."
Any name would do, but none came to her.
"No name? Well, roads are full of nameless girls."
"'The lich yard's even fuller,'
said his wife. As dawn broke, guardsmen appeared on the parapets. The farmers climbed onto their wagons and shook the reins. Brian mounted as well, and took a glance behind her. Most of the queue waiting to enter Duskendale were farm folk, with loads of fruits and vegetables to sell. A pair of wealthy townsmen sat on well-bred palfreys a dozen places behind her, and further back she spied a skinny boy on a piebald roundsey. There was no sign of the two knights, nor Sir Sadric the Mad Mouse. The guards were waving through the wains with scarce a look, but when Brian reached the gate, she gave them pause.
"Halt, you!"
the captain cried. A pair of men in chainmail hauberks crossed their spears to bar her way.
"State your purpose here."
I seek the Lord of Duskendale, or his maester."
The captain's eyes lingered on her shield.
"The Black Bat of Luston? Those are arms of ill repute."
"They're not mine. I mean to have the shield repainted."
"Aye?"
The captain rubbed his stubble chin.
"My sister does such work, as it happens. You'll find her at the house with the painted doors, across from the Seven Swords."
He gestured at the guards.
"Let her pass, lads. It's a wench."
The gatehouse opened on a market square, where those who had entered before her were unloading to hawk their turnips, yellow onions, and sacks of barleycorn. Others were selling arms and armour, and very cheaply, to judge from the prices they shouted out as she rode by.
"The looters come with their carrion crows after every battle."
Brian walked her horse past mail shirts still caked with brown blood, dinted helms, notched longswords. There was clothing to be had as well, leather boots, fur cloaks, stained surcoats with suspicious rents. She knew many of the badges, the mail fist, the moose, the white sun, the double-bladed axe. All those were northern sigils. Tarly men had perished here as well, though, and many from the Stormlands. She saw red and green apples, a shield that bore the three thunderbolts of Laygood, horse trappings patterned with the ants of Ambrose. Lord Tarly's own striding huntsman appeared on many a badge, and brooch, and doublet.
"Friend or foe, the crows care not."
There were pine and linden shields to be had for pennies, but Brian rode past them. She meant to keep the heavy oaken shield Jamie had given her, the one he'd borne himself, from Harrenhal to King's Landing. A pine shield had its advantages. It was lighter, and therefore easier to bear, and the soft wood was more like to trap a foeman's axe or sword. But oak gave more protection, if you were strong enough to bear its weight. Duskendale was built around its harbour. North of town the chalk cliffs rose. To the south a rocky headland shielded the ships at anchor from storms coming up the narrow sea. The castle overlooked the port, its square keep and big drum towers visible from every part of town. In the crowded cobble streets it was easier to walk than ride, so Brian put her mare up in a stable and continued on afoot, with her shield slung across her back and her bedroll tucked up beneath one arm. The captain's sister was not hard to find. The Seven Swords was the largest inn in town, a four-story structure that towered above its neighbours, and the double doors on the house across the way were painted gorgeously. They showed a castle in an autumn wood, the trees done up in shades of gold and russet. Ivy crawled up the trunks of ancient oaks, and even the acorns had been done with loving care. When Brian peered more closely, she saw creatures in the foliage, a sly red fox, two sparrows on a branch, and behind those leaves the shadow of a boar.
"Your door is very pretty," she told the dark-haired woman who answered when she knocked. "What castle is that meant to be?"
"All castles," said the captain's sister.
"The only one I know is the Dunfort by the harbour. I made t'other in me head. What a castle ought to look like. I've never seen a dragon neither, nor a griffin, nor a unicorn."
She had a cheerful manner, but when Brian showed her the shield, her face went dark.
My old ma used to say that giant bats flew out from Harrenhall on moonless nights to carry bad children to Mad Donnell for her cookpots. Sometimes I'd hear them scrabbling at the shutters.
She sucked her teeth a moment, thoughtful.
What goes in its place?
The arms of Tarth were quartered rose and azure, and bore a yellow sun and crescent moon. But so long as men believed her to be a murderess, Brian dare not carry them.
Your door reminds me of an old shield I once saw in my father's armory.
She described the arms as best she could recall them. The woman nodded.
I can paint it straight away, but the paint will need to dry. Take a room at the Seven Swords, if it please you. I'll bring the shield to you by morning.
Brian had not meant to overnight in Duskendale, but it might be for the best. She did not know if the lord of the castle was in residence, or whether he would consent to see her. She thanked the painter and crossed the cobblestones to the inn. Above its door, seven wooden swords swung beneath an iron spike. The whitewash that covered them was cracked and peeling, but Brian knew their meaning. They stood for the seven sons of Darklin, who had worn the white cloaks of the King's Guard. No other house in all the realm could claim as many.
They were the glory of their house, and now they are a sign above an inn.
She pushed into the common room and asked the innkeep for a room and a bath. He put her on the second floor, and a woman with a liver-coloured birthmark on her face brought up a wooden tub and then the water, pail by pail.
"Do any Darklings remain in Duskendale?"
Brian asked as she climbed into the tub.
"Well, there's Darks. I'm one myself. My husband says I was dark before we wed, and darker afterwards."
She laughed.
"Can't throw a stone in Duskendale without you hit some Dark or Darkwood or Dargood. But the lordly Darklings are all gone. Lord Dennis was the last of them, the sweet young fool. Did you know the Darklings were kings in Duskendale before the Andals come? You'd never know to look at me, but I got me royal blood. Oh, can you see it? Your Grace, another cup of ale?"
I ought to make them say,
"Your Grace, the chamber pot needs emptying, and fetch in some fresh faggots. Your bloody Grace, the fire's going out."
She laughed again, and shook the last drops from the pail.
"Well, there you are. Is that water hot enough for you?"
"It will serve."
The water was lukewarm.
"I'd bring up more, but it'd just slop over. A girl the size of you, you fill a tub."
"Only a cramped small tub like this one."
At Harrenhall, the tubs had been huge and made of stone. The bathhouse had been thick with the steam rising off the water, and Jamie had come walking through that mist, naked as his name day, looking half a corpse and half a god.
"He climbed into the tub with me,"
she remembered, blushing. She seized a chunk of hard lye soap and scrubbed under her arms, trying to call up Renly's face again. By the time the water had gone cold, Brian was as clean as she was like to get. She put on the same clothes she had taken off and girded her sword belt tight around her hips, but her mail and helm she left behind, so as not to seem so threatening at the Dunfort. It felt good to stretch her legs. The guards at the castle gates wore leather jacks with a badge that showed crossed war hammers upon a white saltire.
"I would speak with your lord,"
Brian told them. One laughed.
"Best shut out Loudon."
"Lord Riker rode to Maidenpool with Randall Tarley," the other said. "He left Sir Rufus Leake, Ascascalon, to look after Lady Riker and the young ones."
It was to Leake that they escorted her. Sir Rufus was a short, stout greybeard, whose left leg ended in a stump.
You will forgive me if I do not rise,"
he said. Brian offered him her letter, but Leake could not read. So he sent her to the maester, a bald man with a freckled scalp and a stiff red moustache. When he heard the name Hollard, the maester frowned with irritation.
How often must I sing this song?
Her face must have given her away.
Do you think you were the first to come seeking after Dantas? More like the 21st.
The gold cloaks were here within days of the king's murder.
With Lord Tywin's warrant. And what do you have, pray?
Brian showed him the letter, with Tommen's seal and childish signature. The maester hummed and hawed, picking at the wax, and finally gave it back.
Well, it seems in order.
He climbed onto a stool and gestured Brian to another.
I never knew, Sir Dantas. He was a boy when he left Duskendale. The Hollards were a noble house once, 'tis true. You know their arms, berry red and pink, with three golden crowns upon a blue cheap. The Darklands were petty kings during the Age of Heroes, and three took Hollard wives. Later, the little realm was swallowed up by larger kingdoms. Yet the Darklands endured, and the Hollards served them. Aye, even in defiance. You know of that? A little.
Her own maester used to say that it was the defiance of Duskendale that had driven King Aerys mad.
In Duskendale, they loved Lord Dennis still, despite the woe he brought them. It is Lady Sorala that they blame, his Myrish wife. The Lace Serpent, she is called. If Lord Darkling had anywhere to Stanton or a Stokeworth, well, you know how small folk would go on. The Lace Serpent filled her husband's ear with Myrish poison, they say, until Lord Dennis rose against his king and took him captive. In the taking, his master-at-arms, Sir Simon Hollard, cut down Sir Gawain Gaunt of the King's Guard. For half a year, Aerys was held within these very walls, whilst the king's hand sat outside Duskendale with a mighty host. Lord Tywin had sufficient strength to storm the town any time he wished, but Lord Dennis sent word that at the first sign of assault he'd kill the king. Brienne remembered what came next.
"The king was rescued," she said. "Barristan the Bold brought him out."
"He did," the maester said. "Once Lord Dennis lost his hostage, he opened his gates and ended his defiance rather than let Lord Tywin take the town. He bent the knee and begged for mercy, but the king was not of a forgiving mind. Lord Dennis lost his head, as did his brothers and his sister, uncles, cousins, all the lordly Darklands. The Lace Serpent was burned alive, poor woman, though her tongue was torn out first, and her female parts, with which it was said that she had enslaved her lord. Half of Duskendale would still tell you that Aerys was too kind to her.
And the Allards?
Tainted and destroyed, said the maester. I was forging my chain at the citadel when this happened, but I have read the accounts of their trials and punishments. Sir John Harlaw, the steward, was wed to Lord Dennis's sister and died with his wife, as did their young son, who was half Darkling. Robin Hollard was a squire, and when the king was seized, he danced around him and pulled his beard. He died upon the wreck. Sir Simon Hollard was slain by Sir Barristan during the king's escape. The Hollard lands were taken, their castle torn down, their villages put to the torch. As with the Darklands, House Hollard was extinguished.
Save for Dantas.
True enough. Young Dantas was a son of Sir Stephen Hollard, the twin brother of Sir Simon, who had died of a fever some years before, and had no part in the defiance. Aerys would have taken the boy's head off nonetheless, but Sir Barristan asked that his life be spared. The king could not refuse the man who saved him, so Dantas was taken to King's Landing as a squire. To my knowledge, he never returned to Duskendale, and why should he?
He held no lands here, had neither kin nor castle. If Dantas and this northern girl helped murder our sweet king, it seems to me that they would want to put as many leagues as they could betwixt themselves and justice. Look for them in Old Town if you must, or across the narrow sea. Look for them in Dorn or on the wall. Look elsewhere.
He rose.
I hear my ravens calling. You will forgive me if I bid you good morrow.
The walk back to the inn seemed longer than the walk to the Don Fort, though perhaps that was only her mood. She would not find Sansa Stark in Duskendale, that seemed plain. If Ser Dontus had taken her to Old Town or across a narrow sea, as the maester seemed to think, Brian's quest was hopeless.
What was there for her in Old Town? She asked herself. The maester never knew her, no more than he knew Hollard. She would not have gone to strangers.
In King's Landing, Brian had found one of Sansa's former maids doing washing in a brothel.
I served with Lord Renly before my Lady Sansa, and both turned traitor.
The woman Brella complained bitterly.
No lord would touch me now, so I have to wash for whores.
But when Brian asked about Sansa, she said,
I'll tell you what I told Lord Tarwin. That girl was always praying. She go to sept and light her candles like a proper lady, but near every night she went off to the Godswood. She's gone back north, she has. That's where her guards are.
The north was huge, though, and Brian had no notion which of her father's bannermen Sansa might have been most inclined to trust.
Or would she seek her own blood instead?
Though all of her siblings had been slain, Brian knew that Sansa still had an uncle and a bastard half-brother on the wall, serving in the night's watch. Another uncle, Edmure Tully, was a captive at the Twins, but his uncle, Sir Brydon, still held River Run, and Lady Caitlin's younger sister ruled the Vale.
Blood calls to blood.
Sansa might well have run to one of them. Which one, though? The wall was too far, surely, and a bleak and bitter place besides. And to reach Riveron, the girl would need to cross the worn-torn riverlands and pass through the Lannister siege lines. The area would be simpler, and Lady Lysa would surely welcome her sister's daughter. Ahead, the alley bent. Somehow, Brian had taken a wrong turn. She found herself in a dead end, a small muddy yard, where three pigs were rooting around a low stone well. One squealed at the sight of her, and an old woman drawing water looked her up and down suspiciously.
"What will you be wanting?"
"I was looking for the seven swords."
"Back the way you come. Left at the sept."
"I thank you."
Brian turned to retrace her steps and walked headfirst into someone hurrying round the bend. The collision knocked him off his feet, and he landed on his arse in the mud.
"Pardons," she murmured. He was only a boy, a scrawny lad with straight, thin hair and a sty beneath one eye. "Are you hurt?"
She offered a hand to help him up, but the boy squirmed back away from her on heels and elbows. He could not have been more than 10 or 12, though he wore a chainmail burnie and had a longsword in a leather sheath slung across his back.
"Do I know you?"
Brian asked. His face seemed vaguely familiar, though she could not think from where.
"No, you don't. You never..."
He scrambled to his feet.
Forgive me, my lady, I wasn't looking. I was, but down. I was looking down at my feet."
The boy took to his heels, plunging headlong back the way he'd come. Something about him roused all of Brian's suspicions. But she was not about to chase him through the streets of Duskendale.
"Outside the gates this morning, that was where I saw him,"
she realized.
"He was riding a piebald roundsey, and it seemed as if she had seen him somewhere else as well. But where?"
By the time Brian found the seven swords again, the common room was crowded. Four scepters sat closest to the fire, in robes stained and dusty from the road. Elsewhere, locals filled the benches, supping up bowls of hot crab stew with chunks of bread. The smell made her stomach rumble, but she saw no empty seats. Then a voice behind her said,
"Milady, here, have my place."
Not until he hopped off the bench did Brian realize that the speaker was a dwarf. The little man was not quite 5 feet tall. His nose was veined and bulbous, his teeth red from sour leaf, and he was dressed in the brown, rough-spun robes of a holy brother, with the iron hammer of the smith dangling down about his thick neck.
"Keep your seat," she said. "I can stand as well as you."
"Aye, but my head is not so apt to knock upon the ceiling."
The dwarf's speech was coarse, but courteous. Brian could see the crown of his scalp where he had shaved it. Many holy brothers wore such tonsures. Scepter Roel once told her that it was meant to show that they had nothing to hide from the father.
"Can't the father see through hair?"
Brian had asked.
A stupid thing to say.
She had been a slow child. Scepter Roel often told her so. She felt near a stupid now, so she took the little man's place at the end of the bench, signalled for stew, and turned to thank the dwarf.
"Do you serve some holy house in Duskendale, brother?"
"'Twas nearer Maidenpool, m'lady, but the walls burned us out,"
the man replied, gnawing on a heel of bread.
"We rebuilt as best we could until some sellswords come. I could not say whose men they were, but they took our pigs and killed the brothers. I squeezed inside a hollow log and hid, but t'others were too big. It took me a long time to bury them all, but the smith, he gave me strength. When that was done, I dug up a few coins the elder brother had hid by, and set off by myself."
"I met some other brothers going to King's Landing."
"Aye, there's hundreds on the roads, not only brothers, septons too, and small folk, sparrows all. Might be I'm a sparrow too. The smith, he made me small enough." He chuckled. And what's your sad tale, m'lady?"
"I'm looking for my sister. She's high-born, only 3 and 10, a pretty maid, with blue eyes and auburn hair. You may have seen her travelling with a man. A knight, perhaps a fool. There's gold for the man who helps me find her."
"Gold?" The brother gave her a red smile. "A bowl of that crab stew would be enough reward for me, but I fear I cannot help you. Fools I've met, and plenty, but not so many pretty maids."
He cocked his head and thought a moment.
"There was a fool at Maidenpool, now that I think of it. He was clad in rags and dirt, as near as I could tell, but under the dirt was motley."
"Did Duntus Hollard wear motley?"
No one had told Brian that he did, but no one had ever said he didn't either. Why would the man be in rags, though? Had some misfortune overtaken him and Sansa after they fled King's Landing? That could well be, were the roads so dangerous.
It might not have been him at all. Did this fool have a red nose, full of broken veins?
I could not swear to that, I confess. I paid him little heed. I'd gone to Maidenpool after burying my brothers, thinking that I might find a ship to take me to King's Landing. I first glimpsed the fool down by the docks. He had a furtive air to him, and took care to avoid Lord Tarly's soldiers. Later I encountered him again at the Stinking Goose.
"The Stinking Goose,"
she said, uncertain.
"An unsavoury place," the dwarf admitted. "Lord Tarly's men patrol the port at Maidenpool, but the Goose is always full of sailors, and sailors have been known to smuggle men aboard their ships, if the price is right. This fool was seeking passage for 3 across the narrow sea. I oft saw him there, talking with oarsmen off the galleys. Sometimes he would sing a funny song."
"Seeking passage for 3? Not 2. 3, m'lady."
"That I'd swear to, by the 7.
Three, she thought. Sansa, Sir Dantus. But who would be the third? The imp? Did the fool find his ship?
And that's